Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Mark Crispin Miller on propaganda, capitalism, empire, and the media. Could there be a connection? You betcha. I hope you'll stay tuned. I was a kid during the original Cold War. I remember reading articles back then explaining how to tell commie propaganda from God's and the United States' truth. Basically, it boiled down to this. If it's printed in the Daily Worker, it's propaganda. If it's printed in the New York Times, it's God's own truth. Just the other day, I happened to pick up that megaphone of God's own truth, the New York Times. March 13, 2019 it was. And there on page 5 was a big article on Venezuela. The headline read, quote, "Options fading, U.S. remains stymied on how to oust Venezuelan ruler," unquote. Let me read that one again. Options fading, U.S. remains stymied on how to oust Venezuelan ruler. Now, the technical term for this little sleight of hand is begging the question. The real important issue here is not argued, but merely assumed. And then the debate is diverted to a corollary. One would think that the real issue ought to be this. Should the United States violate international law and its own claimed principles and overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela? But if you put the issue that way, everyone would say no, right? But the powers that be want U.S. forces to depose Venezuela's government. So U.S. public opinion has to be changed. And so we get public opinion molding like this alleged news story. The story pretends that the desirability of overthrow is so obvious that the only thing left to debate is the means. But even this looks like it will be a short debate. The headline strongly suggests that we will probably be forced to bomb the hell out of Caracas and then send in the Marines. And when we do, don't blame anyone on our side for such a flagrant violation of international law. All of our options short of war faded, you see. Venezuela forced us to go to war with them. So what is the Times doing? It is shaping public opinion, preparing Americans for the undemocratic and unlawful overthrow of the government of Venezuela. It is also laying the groundwork to get public opinion to approve a U.S. military invasion of Venezuela, if that is what it takes to overthrow the government and install a corporate-friendly stooge in power, namely Mr. Guaido. When some or all of this comes to pass, you will feel that the overthrow was inevitable and necessary. Golly, the United States simply didn't have any other options. In a word, this article is blatant propaganda. Propaganda is not some communist import. It's a classic, traditional tool of American capitalist government. And the U.S. government propaganda machine has been running full tilt for the past 100 years. Since the days just before World War I, when Woodrow Wilson called in Edward Bernays and George Creel to sell the war that Americans didn't want, but the Morgans and Rockefellers did. Media scholar Mark Crispin Miller talks about the connections among American propaganda, capitalism, empire, and the corporate-controlled media. These edited remarks are from a conversation he had with journalist Abby Martin in June 2016. Miller begins with the so-called father of modern public relations, Edward Bernays.
When did public opinion begin to stand out as a force to be managed by the establishment?
For all intents and purposes, I think it's probably most accurate to say that World War I marked an important turning point in the rise of what we call public opinion as a consideration for political leaders and the science of propaganda, which was used and has been used with increasing sophistication to move public opinion in certain directions, basically to make sure that we don't succumb to anything like real democracy, you know? I mean, public opinion has to be respected, but not out of any respect for the popular will. It has to be respected as a kind of mighty beast that needs to be tamed unless democracy break out and upset the apple cart. What Bernays understood brilliantly was the need to kind of shape the flow of events to influence the media in a general way, to create an atmosphere in which large numbers of people would end up making certain choices, coming to certain conclusions without really being aware of any stimulus, you see. So he had a lot of contempt for advertising because it was too explicit. It was too blatant. It was saying, buy this. I mean, it wasn't quite as simplistic as he made it sound. He badmouthed advertising and disdained it in favor of his own method. It was to kind of create the climate in which people would do certain things to benefit his clients. My favorite example is that he represented a piano company. How to get people to buy pianos? Well, he did this by creating a craze for music rooms in homes, right? He actually contacted people in the architectural magazines and so on, and in the news media, people who wrote about lifestyle and so on. They didn't use that term then. In order to create a kind of trend for music rooms. Okay, well, you have a music room, what are you going to put in it? I mean, obviously, most middle and upper middle class people want to buy pianos, you see. So even though he never mentioned the name of the piano company, and didn't even harp on pianos per se in the propaganda, it had the general net effect of getting people to buy more pianos, so the client was happy. He had a contract to help increase sales for American Tobacco, and one of the most important things that he did to that end was to get Hollywood to incorporate cigarette smoking much more consciously and often artfully into the scenarios of movies, to get them to write cigarette smoking, lighting up, and so on, to write all that into the stories, you see. So it developed a kind of grammar of, you know, seduction, and, you know, you could express various kinds of emotions with cigarettes, depending on, you know, who lit you up or whatever. But the point I'm trying to make is that he understood that the inexplicit influence, just creating a large-scale shift in the weather, you know, to get people to do certain things. That was his great insight, you see. And now you ask, how did that come to define our world, basically? Mm-hmm. Let me answer that question by stepping back to say that I think that we live at a moment when propaganda has never been so pervasive, has never been so influential, has never been so dangerous. And I mean propaganda. I know that the word sounds terribly quaint. I say propaganda, people think of, you know, Chinese voices coming squawking over loudspeakers in Beijing, or they think of Soviet posters, right? Or Nazi propaganda. They think of Leni Riefenstahl. Actually, propaganda is not a totalitarian phenomenon primarily, although we have long since learned to think that it is. Propaganda is as American as apple pie. Propaganda at its most sophisticated was perfected, and I mean not just political propaganda, but commercial propaganda. Both kinds of propaganda were perfected jointly by the United States and Britain. In Mein Kampf, Hitler, in his famous chapter on war propaganda, talks about how deeply he admired what a brilliant job the British propagandists had done in World War I, had nothing but contempt for the German propaganda, and resolved to make sure that his own and the Nazi Party's propaganda would be brilliant in imitation of the British. So how many people does the world of propaganda employ in the United States, if you think about it? I mean, it isn't only people in public relations. It's also people in advertising agencies. It's also people in the world of so-called public diplomacy. It's also people in the world of what we call lobbying. There are countless euphemisms that we use today for propaganda, right? If you go up to a person in an ad agency or a PR specialist and say, well, how's the propaganda going? You know, they're going to be insulted. They're going to feel like you've called them a dirty name. They don't understand that they do propaganda, right? They do propaganda. And the rise of all those euphemisms for it is a direct result of the successful effort to cast propaganda as something that they do in those closed societies. The Russians do it. The Chinese do it. The Iranians do it. The Venezuelans do it. The Cubans do it. We don't do it. We educate people. We provide them with information. And that misrepresentation of propaganda has had the paradoxical effect of making it extraordinarily effective. See, because propaganda works best when you don't see it for what it is. People tend to pride themselves on not falling for propaganda. People say, you know, commercials don't work on me. You know, I can see through them. And there are a number of ad campaigns that have successfully appealed to that idea, the kind of winking, ironic advertising. It and you share a little chuckle or a little smirk over the fact that you're too smart to fall for this, right? This is kind of a postmodern move that advertising makes. Well, it's been making it in various ways really since the 30s, okay? People don't understand that even if they consciously scorn a particular ad as cheesy, or they tell themselves they don't really believe the claims, that has nothing to do with what they'll end up buying if they happen to get thirsty and they go into a store somewhere. But let's move away from the world of what they call white propaganda, which is to say propaganda that announces itself as propaganda. That's TV commercials, political speeches, stuff like that. And let's move into the world of what we call gray propaganda, which is propaganda that disguises itself as journalism or any number of dodges and disguises that propaganda puts on, right? Product placement in movies is a form of gray propaganda. And then a movie like Argo, for example, or Zero Dark Thirty, to move to more sinister examples, are movies that have a kind of geopolitical agenda that are, making a case for very powerful interests within the state, movies that the CIA has actually helped the producers make.
And let's talk about what's behind the propaganda. Bernays is quoted as saying, "We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we've never heard of. Who are the invisible governors that are controlling these ideas?"
It's important to note that Bernays didn't think of that as a bad thing. He thought that was a good thing because his assumption was that these august figures, these mighty figures in the worlds of business and politics and the media, were essentially benign. He actually believed that. He thought there was a kind of rationality operating up top, which, you know, as I point out in my own introduction to the new edition of propaganda, is a groundless claim, because often people who devote themselves to propaganda end up believing it themselves. If you have a vested interest in a particular version of the truth, you're going to believe it.
It goes into just here we are today, where 90% of what Americans see, hear, and read is controlled by six corporations, six giant umbrella corporations. How does this function? You've called it a cartel, because it seems like every single outlet echoes the exact same narrative and pro-U.S. bias.
Yes, that's right. You know, for a long time, I used to think that what's happened to the media is entirely a matter of runaway deregulation, too much concentration of power, too few independent voices, too little broadcast regulation and so on. And I think that that has a great deal to do with it. But I now realize that there's another factor that has to be considered as well, and that is the energetic involvement of the covert side of our own government in the news and entertainment business. Countless people within the media are either wittingly involved with our intelligence agencies, you know, which is something that started to be exposed in the 70s with the congressional hearings, not just the CIA, but the FBI as well.
I thought that it was a matter of real concern that planted stories intended to serve a national purpose abroad came home and were circulated here and believed here, because this would mean that the CIA could manipulate the news in the United States by channeling it through some foreign country.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to a major circulation American journal?
We do have people who submit pieces to other two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
But then there are also a lot of people who are manipulated in traditional ways. They have sources inside the government who will give them certain tips, give them certain stories, and they end up becoming dependent on those sources for that kind of information. They break really big stories and so on, and then they, I think without even knowing it, end up carrying water for those agencies. You can hire people, you can actually pay them, you can have them under contract, which is chilling and wrong in a democracy for the government to be paying people who are supposed to be providing the public with news to basically insert state propaganda into that news. It's wrong, but it's only one way of many in which the press and often the entertainment industries end up reflecting, serving the agenda of the state and very powerful corporations. How else to explain the bizarre unanimity that we notice today of the press on certain stories that they somehow managed to get absolutely wrong over and over and over and over? I mean, I've been around for a long time studying the media in this country for decades. I've really never seen anything like this. There's an Alice in Wonderland quality to it, because we live in a country that prides itself on freedom of expression and the marketplace of ideas. And yet we see over and over and over and over again on issue after issue, there's a certain truth that is enforced with exactly the same kind of ruthlessness and impatience with any disagreement that you'll find in countries like North Korea.
It's not like it's some big conspiracy theory where there's just 100 guys in a room smoking, figuring out, here, we're going to pull this on this news agency, Fox is going to air this. The interlocking boards of directorates, the sponsorship, the direct-to-consumer advertising, especially when it comes to pharmaceutical agencies, how would you say it works? Is it just a machine functioning on its own and people are self-censoring and they just know they can't touch certain subjects?
Sometimes it happens at the moment because of a particular interest exerting pressure. A lot of times it happens in this way, you know, that a particular interest is vigilant in its own defense, is on the lookout for any kind of coverage that's going to screw with their bottom line, and then this has been going on for 100 years, okay? Mm-hmm. But you raised a really important point at the end of your question about self-censorship. And you used the phrase conspiracy theory a moment ago, and I think it's important that we talk about that, because that will help us understand exactly how this works, you know, conspiracy theory. People like me, people like you, are often, you know, dismissed, ridiculed, derided as conspiracy theorists. And this has become especially urgent and kind of vehement recently, where David Cameron of Britain actually said twice that conspiracy theorists are as dangerous as ISIS.
We must be clear. To defeat the ideology of extremism, we need to deal with all forms of extremism not just violent extremism.
And after the Charlie Hebdo thing, François Hollande came out and said they were actually going to come up with legislation to make conspiracy theory illegal. His notion of conspiracy theory was a weird jumble of, you know, anti-Semitic fantasies and, you know, 9/11 truth and people questioning vaccines and fans of Putin, fans of Chavez. It was a kind of grab bag of forbidden topics, you know what I mean? But actually, to make it illegal, right? Conspiracy theory illegal? Well, when we hear this kind of hysterical attack on what they call conspiracy theory, we have to ask ourselves, what exactly is that? Where did that come from? What do they mean? And having been myself kind of marginalized as a conspiracy theorist right after I came out with my book on election fraud, Fooled Again, 2005, I became very interested in this question, you know, since when are we worried about something called conspiracy theory? Well, the answer to the question is that the notion of conspiracy theory, you know, that meme was pretty much non-existent in American journalism until the late 60s. If you go back and look into the archives of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and you type in conspiracy theory, you'll find very few examples. And the examples you will find are very inconsistent. The phrase is used in many different ways. Starting in 1967, there's a change. And this has everything to do with the fact that it was in the spring of 1967 that the CIA sent a memo out to all station chiefs worldwide alerting them to the fact that there had just been published a number of books attacking the Warren Commission report. The memo defends the Warren Commission report and urges the station chiefs for the CIA all over the world to use their propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these authors wherever possible. From that moment on, we find conspiracy theory popping up more and more often, used over and over and over and over again, and always in the same way. It's always used, or almost always used, to attack people who are raising questions about state crimes. So it's the Kennedy assassination, or the Bobby Kennedy assassination, or the King assassination. It's Iran-Contra, you know? It's election fraud.
I hate the way that the language has been hijacked to the point where you can't even talk about real open conspiracies that are documented. You can talk about a couple conspiring to kill their child. You can't talk about Wall Street conspiring or financial institutions conspiring to rig currency markets, which we know just happened. I mean, these conspiracies are off limits.
That's right.
Let's talk about going back to the media in terms of, you know, it wasn't just that they were complicit in selling the Iraq war. It's every war. It's every issue. Doubling down on U.S. militarism and basically neoliberal doctrine. Every time there's anything going on, there's just this slew of military generals on TV and also in these alt publications and online journals and such. It's just bizarre. It's like, how did that play out?
Yeah, just a few cranks out there in the world of alternative journalism will raise questions about the propriety of having all these generals appear as talking heads to bless the latest military adventure. And they're always on the boards of the big defense contractors. Defense contractors. This is how propaganda works, right? It gets worked into the language that we all use.
Yeah.
Defense. It's not defense, you know. But, yeah, absolutely. They're all basically singing from the same sheet music, you know. And this has been increasing, intensifying, tightening up since the 70s, where there was a brief moment of a kind of uncertainty and division, a response to the Vietnam War, which divided the elites. There was a moment when, I mean, Watergate, of course, enabled people to take a skeptical view of executive power, and the CIA was under fire to some extent, you know, being investigated by Congress. There was a moment there in the middle of that decade when there was a window kind of cracked open, and that window was quickly slammed shut by the late 70s, and then the so-called Reagan Revolution kind of settled our hash for a very, very long time. But I do think, again, and not just using my own students as an example, but young people generally, the Black Lives Matter movement, Occupy, you know, these disparate rebellions suggest as inequality becomes more and more egregious and obvious and destructive, as austerity measures become more and more lethal, people are moving their way towards saying no to things that they hadn't even really thought about just a few years ago.
What is the relationship today between maintaining empire and the propaganda model?
I think that the propaganda that batters us all is so repetitious and monotone precisely because it is at the service of a kind of single dominant, use the word hegemon. I think that that's the truth, that's the case. All of our wars or all of our warlike behaviors as a nation seem to be devoted to wiping out any kind of opposition to or divergence from the neoliberal program. I mean, they've pretty much done away with a lot of the liberationist movements, you know, that were pretty frisky in the 70s and into the 80s. But we do see them going after Venezuela, for example, which is a kind of aftershock from that long struggle against the left. But the attacks on regimes that are not leftist in any real progressive sense, you know, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq or Gaddafi's Libya or Assad's Syria, are part of this kind of blind push to wipe out all resistance to create a perfect Pax Americana.
Media scholar Mark Crispin Miller in conversation with Abby Martin on propaganda, capitalism, empire, and the mass media. Many thanks to the program The Empire Files on the Telesur Network for the audio, which I have condensed a bit. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then,